Good morning. You are listening to Cutting Edge with Anita, featuring conversations with leading experts from around the world in the scientific, historical, and medical fields, plus arts, entertainment, and anything else that's fascinating. Each week, you'll hear about discoveries and the people behind them. Your host, Anita Findlay, is a gerontologist and publisher of Boomer Times and Senior Life. Cutting Edge with Anita is underwritten by Boomer Times and Senior Life, a lifestyle magazine targeted to baby boomers and seniors residing in the South Florida area. For information, go online to babyboomers-seniors.com.
This week's show has wow conversations you'll want to hear and share with your friends. Everyone over 50 complains about joint discomfort. In his book, Healing Arthritis the Natural Way, the breakthrough program for reversing arthritis using nutrition and supplements, Dr. Luke Bucci explains what you can do to relieve your arthritis pain. The raging popularity of electric bikes in Europe is just beginning to grab the attention of gas-weary, green-conscious Americans. So we wanted to get you caught up on the latest motorized bike we could find, one with all the bells and whistles. Mark Pultiskier, Director of Marketing for the E-Plus electric bike, will describe a bike with the power, elegance, and flexibility that Americans demand. If you like to look up at skyscrapers, then do we have a treat for you. Carol Willis, urban historian, architect, and founder, director of the Skyscraper Museum in New York City, shares her love for skyscrapers both here in America and across the world. If you haven't heard of Next Step Institute of Integrative Medicine, Executive Director Kathleen Weiss will talk about the latest healing therapies, including the programs using Native American healings. You're aware that your dog's hearing is very sensitive, but did you know that you can create an environment of sound to improve the health and behavior of your canine companion? Lisa Spector, musician, and Joshua Leeds, psychoacoustician, explain what this music can do, and you will hear what it actually sounds like. Seems like everyone over 50 complains about joint discomfort. So Dr. Luke R. Bucci, in his book Healing Arthritis the Natural Way, the breakthrough program for reversing arthritis using nutrition and supplements, is a very popular book. Dr. Bucci, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Anita. Glad to be here.
Well, I know you have a lot to say about people with joint discomfort. Is everyone going to have joint discomfort?
Well, not everybody, but the vast majority of us will have some degree of it. And for probably 20 to 30% of us, it's going to be close to crippling. It's going to seriously restrict lifestyle.
What's causing this?
Yeah, that's a good question. There's a lot of reasons. It's multifactorial, meaning there are many causes, but it's going to boil down to somebody's genetics. It's still that black box. And you can moderate the effects by keeping weight in the normal range, by the right kind of exercise, not too much, by avoiding injuries to joints, and by your diet, which also includes supplements.
So when we were told about taking cod liver oil when I was a little girl, I guess there was something into that.
Actually, yes. And research from the Norway and the Scandinavian countries is looking into cod liver oil again for people with arthritis, and they are now documenting benefits that were well known by our mothers and fathers.
What part do your genes play?
I think that's where some of the cutting edge on arthritis is going to come from in the near future, that it's not one arthritis gene. It's a bunch of them, and they give you shades of gray of getting joint problems, being more susceptible. Or being more susceptible to the wrong things in your lifestyle, like smoking, for example, causes free radicals that can damage joints. And some people are going to be more sensitive than others. So the genetics are also in in the joint cells themselves and how they're able to respond to inflammatory signals and respond to immune system cells, and also the immune system cells themselves. Are they going to attack the joint or not? So rheumatoid arthritis has already been linked to a certain kind of cell recognition gene that puts out cell recognition patterns and proteins so that your immune system doesn't think your joints are you. It thinks it's a giant bacteria or something. So, of course, it's going to attack it. So I think we're going to see a lot, hundreds of genes, actually, that are going to influence it. It's going to be complicated. But I think the bottom line is that they all point to that the joints are being given the wrong signals. They're told to stop maintenance and repair and start to break down.
Am I giving my joints that signal?
You may not have a choice, but fortunately, that's where I think some of the cutting-edge advancements in joint care are going to solve that problem so that we don't have to really worry or fret about, oh, which genes do I have or not have or which ones are activated or not. I think that the first step here is already in the shelves in marketplaces now. I don't think consumers have realized that many dietary supplements designed for joint health have a lot of herbal extracts in them. And although the regulations prohibit supplement manufacturers from treating diseases or making comparisons to drugs, a lot of these herbal extracts are actually very potent anti-inflammatories, but they don't work the way the typical drugs do. So they have a lot of safety. And so they're mild anti-inflammatories is a way to look at them. And that means that they'll start working quicker than the bread and butter nutrients such as glucosamine or chondroitin. They might start working in a week or a few days or 2 weeks and then show progressive improvements. And that's been a quiet revolution. And trust me, the work goes on every day to find something that works stronger, faster, that can fit into a supplement pill.
Well, then when you wrote your book, and you've written a few books, of course, but the book we're talking about now, Healing Arthritis the Natural Way, why did you write that? What is not the natural way, first of all?
Well, taking synthetic compounds that are analgesic, in other words, they stop the pain, but they do nothing for your joints. That's been well documented in the scientific and medical literature that people come to the doctor office, they say, this hurts. Doctors say, take this, you won't hurt. In the meantime, the joint is still going downhill, and sooner or later you need more medications to prevent the hurt, which will then start to lead to more of the side effects of the drugs, which have serious consequences. And I think we've seen some of that with the recall of the COX-2 inhibitor drugs lately. And the prevalence of stomach ulceration from just over-the-counter analgesics like the NSAIDs and aspirin itself. I mean, that's I think, why I wrote the book, is to let people know, hey, you can give your joints the right signals from what they're normally used to listening to, and that's these nutrients, the nutrient precursors that are part of your joints, like glucosamine, like chondroitin. That concept was new. It's worked pretty well for a lot of people. It won't work for everyone. In other words, if you don't have cartilage, there's not much else you can do, which would get us to the next kind of topic in a minute. But that's, I think, why I wrote the book, was to let people know, hey, you have other options that are healthy, that work with your body, that don't just mask the pain. They actually make your joints repair themselves to whatever extent they can, which the drugs nowadays just don't do.
As I was watching the Olympics, I was thinking about all the joint pain, knowing I was going to talk to you today. I was thinking about the joint pain that those athletes must feel.
Oh, yeah. They have overuse, and that leads to a real short-term kind of inflammation that will go away. But if they get a serious injury or if they continue to overuse the joints, that can set up osteoarthritis later in life. In other words, the joints are what I call an underprivileged tissue. They get very poor blood supply. There's no blood vessels inside of joints. you know, except for a few in the meniscus of the knee, joints don't have blood vessels. They would get in the way, they'd break, they'd bleed, and then your joint wouldn't work, and then the lion would eat you, and you're out of the gene pool back in the caveman days. So, therefore, joint cells just don't get much nutrition. They're semi-starved all the time. So that's why supplementation really helps them out more than, even so than other cells of the body. They get a little boost when they desperately need a boost. So, yep, those Olympians are going to have to worry about what they can do immediately, but, yeah, look out 20, 30 years down the road. They may find out that all that overwork has cost them. Now, I don't want to make people think, oh, well, I need to stop exercising. No, the right amount of exercise, not overdoing it, is very healthy to joints. It actually pumps the joint fluid into the cartilage, which is how it's fed. So you should move, you should exercise. Just don't exercise to the point of hurting your joints all the time.
That was my next question about exercise. Well, in the 3 minutes we have left, why don't we talk about something that's really cutting edge that you wanted to share?
Well, what I'm real excited about are all these, what I call newfangled research interests. One of them is stem cells. I know it's a controversial topic, but you can actually now take stem cells from joints of a person, grow their own cartilage in a test tube and plant it back in. This is going to be good for people that don't have any cartilage. Now, there are changes to the bone they have to work on to make that really work, but I think we're going to start seeing your own tissues transplanted or implanted back in certain joints. You know, TMJ or finger joints might be good candidates for this. But you got to start catching it earlier so that the cartilage will have something to grow into. It's like putting sod in good soil rather than a rock. Also, this gene technology is showing us which genes are more important than others, are more important than thought, and I think we are going to see new drug therapies that are going to have far fewer side effects and just stop that loss of cartilage virtually cold. They're going to almost make osteoarthritis obsolete. I think we're somewhere between 5 and 10 years for this new gene technology guided drugs to start appearing, and about that time for when we can actually start replacing our joints with stuff we grew in a test tube, so to speak. That has some real promise. There's a lot of people working on it. It's starting to work in animals. It's working in the laboratory settings. So it's only a matter of time before it gets in our joints ourselves.
Well, we have had guests talking about stem cells, so it's important. I think that's the wave of the future. And I'm glad that you brought that up. My guest has been Luke Bucci. And I must say, Dr. Bucci, you really are someone that makes difficult subjects very simple. And I have so many more questions to ask you, but maybe we'll have to do that another time. If you want more information, go to www.schiffvitamins.com. That's S-C-H-I-F-F vitamins.com. And I certainly thank you very much. We'll be looking forward to some more books from you. Looks like you just can't sit down for a moment.
Oh, that's the truth. Thank you, Anita, very much.
Okay. We'll talk to you another time. Bye. It seems like everyone wants to ride a bike now, especially with the prices of course, the price of gas, the price of cars. So there is something that's very exciting, and they're called electric bikes, but not like you've seen before. And so we have asked Mark Pulteskier, who is manager of marketing for the E-Plus electric bike, to describe this bike. Hello, Mark.
Hi, Anita. How are you?
Fine, thank you. So I was telling some of my friends about this bike, and they said, well, electric bikes, they've been electric bikes for years. How is yours different?
Well, electric bikes are really an environmentally friendly transportation alternative. And you're right, there have been many, many bikes before ours. But what is great about the E-Plus electric bicycle is that it is a very, very advanced electric bicycle, but it retains the simplicity of riding a bicycle. Everybody can just jump on, push the thumb throttle on the handlebar, and get up to 20 or 30 miles per hour speeds. It's a lot of fun to ride.
Well, the thing I was thinking, of course, is bicycles now really becoming the way people get to work. This isn't just for fun. This is serious stuff. And I want to be able to put saddlebags on my back. And I really want to be able to use this and not have to spend for gas, because I don't think gas is ever going to go down to what it was before. Do you?
No, I don't think so either. But you're right. You know, cycling is fun. It's a great activity for people of all ages, but it's also a great alternative transportation. And, you know, most people actually live between 5 and 50 miles from their work. They don't need to use their car or SUV every day, especially on a nice day. Now, sometimes people tell me, you know, well, I would like to go cycling. I would like to cycle to work. But not necessarily in the morning, because I don't want to show up all sweaty. I don't have changing facilities at my work. Well, what about a bicycle like the E-Plus that allows you to use a motor to get to work, and then on your way home, you can actually pedal your heart out for the exercise. So people really find that electric bicycles, and in particular the E-Plus electric bicycles, is a great way of commuting to work.
So let's look at bicycles now. You have one for men and one for women, and I always used to laugh about that, because we used to try to jump on our male friends' bicycles. It wasn't as comfortable. And the other question I'm going to ask you is, what about the seats? Because, you know, there's new seats for bicycles, for men especially.
Yes. Well, we have two models available. One is the mountain bike, and one is the cruiser. The cruiser actually has a very, very wide and comfortable saddle. I like that one much better than the mountain bike. It rides, and it's a very, very laid-back riding experience. It has wide handlebars, wide, very, very comfortable seat. And then there's the mountain bike with a narrower seat, shorter handlebar, a little bit more of a sportive feel to it when you're riding it.
Okay, so let's just go through the whole idea of what do we put into electric bikes to make them run. I mean, are these batteries? It's certainly not gasoline.
No. You're right. We have a battery pack mounted into the front wheel, into the spokes of the front wheel, and we place the motor, a motor hub, into the back of the wheel. That allows you to kind of balance the weight of the bicycle very, very easily, very, very evenly, excuse me. And it creates a low center of gravity, making the bicycle very, very easy to handle, whether under electric power or when you pedal it alone without using the motor. And that just creates a great riding experience. It handles like a bike. It rides like a regular bicycle with the added option of a powerful motor.
Now, in Europe, we see this. People use the bikes a lot more. They do this in China. I hope it's going to catch on in the United States. I think we're even having some little cities have bike lanes. Do you see this as being a renewed form of transportation?
Absolutely. I think what we've seen in the last couple of years, and in particular in the last couple of months, that more and more Americans are becoming aware that they need to change their ways at least slightly to counter high gas prices, you know, obesity and traffic congestion. And electric bicycles are really offering a healthy living alternative. It's an environmentally friendly way of living and doing business, for that matter. And you can really enjoy the outdoors, being active, without having to worry about how do I get home at the end of a long ride. So I'm very convinced that you will see electric bikes out there on the cities in the United States more and more.
Do you ride a bike?
I do ride a bike, yes, especially on the weekends. It's a lot of fun. I go out with my family. I go out with my friends. And I have some of my friends that are avid cyclists. They have been riding bicycles for years. They ride really, really fast. I'm not able to keep up with them unless I use my E-Plus electric bicycle. And that works pretty well for us to go, you know, enjoy cycling in a group.
Okay, now I want to talk about helmets. there used to be a law here in Florida that bicyclists had to have helmets. I know motorcyclists had to, and now they don't either. Do you recommend that people use something when they're riding their bike?
Yes. I mean, I think that, you know, helmets are a very important safety tool when you're riding a bicycle, especially if you're riding into an urban environment with cars and other and pedestrians on the street, sharing the streets or sharing the roads with you. It's not required everywhere in the United States, and our electric bicycle, at least the 750-watt version, is governed by the same rules and laws as regular bicycles, even though it has a motor, at least in most of the 50 United States. But we always recommend, whether it's required by law or not, to wear a helmet.
That's very important, and there are families where you see the mother, the father, and the children all wearing their helmets. Now, what age would you recommend for someone to even consider electric bike? I mean, how young?
Well, that's a very good question. I think that, we have people enjoying our bicycle of all ages. I personally would recommend it to people 21 and above, just because, you know, these are very powerful bicycles. You can go up to 30 miles per hour with our 1,000-watt version. So you really have to be, you know, a little bit more mature and to not get into any troubles.
So if I'm going on a camping trip and I have some bicycles and I want to take them with me, am I going to get them, put them on the top of my car? I have seen people with two bicycles on the top of their car, and that's really a little frightening for me because I think with the wind and all. How would you carry your bikes?
I actually have there are several bike racks available that go on, that you can attach to the hatchet on the back, and they actually don't need to go on the top of the roof. So it's much easier and much more comfortable to put the bicycles on the back of the rack. The rack is much lower than the standard racks. For example, Thule has one that is very, very easy to install and very easy to use.
So, yeah, because that is something that's, I think it's a consideration. So if you want to go somewhere and then you decide you don't want to come back by bike, you know, but you want to go, and so you need to figure out all those kinds of things. Well, when I think about the electric bikes, I hear a lot of noise. If I'm sitting out in a cafe enjoying a lunch, and I hear these noises go by. Now, it's not as bad as a motorcycle, but if I had there were a lot of electric bikes, that would make a very loud noise, which, of course, we don't want to be bothered with.
Well, actually, I don't think it was one of our bikes, because the E-Plus electric bicycle is virtually silent. You will only hear the tires on the road. The motor is emission-free, and you don't hear the motor at all.
Yeah, I think that's something that we're all talking about, going green and also, and of course, noise pollution. We talk about that too. And I'm certainly glad that I was able to hear more about electric bikes. Actually, I'm very attracted to electric bikes now. I have had a regular bike, and it takes a lot of energy, and it's okay going, you know, a mile or two or three, but unless you're in a very good shape, I think you have to be careful. So I think electric bikes definitely are the new mode of transportation, and I thank you so much, Mark Pultescare, who is the manager of the marketing for E-Plus Electric Bikes. He's been my guest, and for more information, go to electricmotionsystems.com. Thank you very much, Mark.
Thank you very much, Anita. It's been a pleasure.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Cutting Edge with Anita is underwritten by Boomer Times and Senior Life, a lifestyle magazine targeted to baby boomers and seniors residing in the South Florida area. For information, go online to babyboomers-seniors.com.
Skyscrapers. Oh, I love skyscrapers. I don't want to be in the very top because I probably will get sick and I'll think I'm falling out. But I sure like to look at them, and it seems like now skyscrapers are getting higher and higher. So, Carol Willis, urban historian, architect, and founder director of the Skyscraper Museum in New York City, is going to talk to us and tell us all about why she started the museum and what is going on in the skyscraper world. Hello, Carol.
Hi, Anita. How are you?
Well, this is an unusual idea, I think. And I don't know, how long have you been inventing or thinking about having a skyscraper museum?
Well, I'm the founder, director, and curator of the museum, and I started it 11 years ago in vacant spaces in Lower Manhattan. But it was an idea that really came together through a whole career of scholarship, of teaching and writing about American architecture, and especially a fairly neglected topic, really, among academics, which was the skyscraper. Yet it's the great contribution to world architecture by American architects, so, and engineers, certainly. I mean, it takes a whole host of people and teams in order to design and build skyscrapers. But it's a topic that I've really worked on almost all my adult life.
And so do people consult with you before they decide to build a skyscraper?
No, unfortunately. I don't hold that kind of influence. The drive to build towers is really an economic urge, and my appreciation of them is largely aesthetic and intellectual and academic, but I'm afraid I'm not the person to ask if a building's going to be profitable. I like the way it looks, but the balance sheet is not my business.
And I don't know where I'd have to assume that the museum is not at the top of one of these skyscrapers.
It's not. We're in the ground floor, and if you're a student of urban economics or of real estate, you know that ground floor is the most expensive space in commercial buildings because it's where you have the street traffic and the retail and the commercial space. Unfortunately, since 9/11 in New York in particular, but throughout the U.S., measures for the problems of security mean that the access to upper floors is often restricted.
And so what is going to be the highest skyscraper? I mean, it seems like when we thought there was one, then we hear another one's being built. Is this kind of like who can build a bigger skyscraper?
Well, there is certainly a history of one-upsmanship in skyscraper design and engineering and construction, and that goes back to the late 19th century and early 20th century when you had a whole series of towers like the Singer Tower and then the Metropolitan Life Tower. These are all in New York, and then the Woolworth Tower in 1913, which was the world's tallest building at 792 feet. Then there was another generation with the Chrysler Building and the Empire State Building, and there they pushed the height up to about 1,250 feet. Today, under construction and really almost topped out, certainly its top floor at 160 floors is already finished, but they're still building the finial, the point on the top of the tower of the Burj Dubai, which is in the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, in the Emirate of Dubai, and it's more than twice as tall as the Empire State Building. It's the official final number of feet hasn't been disclosed, but it's somewhere around 2,700 feet.
I'm just wondering about the people who are doing the construction. Do they get paid more the higher they go?
No, not really. And it's sort of an interesting, sort of historical reversal from the early 20th century to today. With the Burj Dubai, that building is built in concrete, so it's reinforced by steel, but it's pumped concrete that is pumped into formwork and then settles, that is the main structure of the building. The building's also a residential building. So here at the beginning of the 21st century, the world's tallest towers are residential buildings that are built of concrete, and then in the Mideast or in Asia. If you look at the 20th century, all through its development is generally a steel building that's an office building in its use, built in the United States, generally in New York or in Chicago, and that was the case through the World Trade Center towers and the Sears Tower, which really culminated the great age of skyscraper architecture and engineering in the 20th century.
And if I were to come to the Skyscraper Museum in New York City, your museum, what am I going to see?
Well, first of all, you'd see a spectacular space because the architect Roger Duffy of Skidmore, Owings & Merrill designed our space, which is not a large museum, and we're not the Metropolitan or the MoMA. We're about 5,000 square feet in Battery Park City, so in lower Manhattan at the tip of Manhattan. You can see out to the harbor and to the Statue of Liberty, so it's a wonderful setting that really is the origins of the colonial city and also the birthplace of the skyscraper. But our space is very contemporary, so we have a stainless steel floor and a stainless steel ceiling that makes what I call a vertical Versailles. It's like the Hall of Mirrors at Versailles, but not in the horizontal dimension, but in the vertical, so that our cases in which we display models and other kinds of artifacts of skyscraper history seem to be like skyscrapers in the space because they seem to make endless verticals.
Well, that must be wonderful. I do look forward to going to the museum at some point. Do you have school children coming through?
We do. We make a special effort in our hours before our public gallery hours, which are Wednesday through Sunday from noon to 6, to have school visits for metropolitan area kids, all grades, but we sort of specialize in the younger grades and the sort of wonder that they have in their eyes when they go on a school trip and they see both a space like this, and some of them come to Lower Manhattan for the first time, and they see, you know, real skyscrapers in the original skyline. So we have educators that take them on tours and show them models and photographs and engage them and interact with them as the kids look at these various objects.
And what kind of other than terrorism, which we don't want to even think about, but would an earthquake, I don't even know if a hurricane would have much impact, what would really happen? Mm-hmm.
Well, I know you've been having some weather down there. Skyscrapers are definitely designed to withstand the forces of nature. Earthquakes, so seismic events, and typhoons or hurricanes are all part of the engineering equation and the research that goes into designing the tower and then constructing and, of course, making it waterproof. And the curtain wall of glass needs to have all kinds of both special engineering and also gaskets and things that keep it waterproof. And these buildings are tested in models in wind tunnels for wind velocities of 200 miles an hour or more. And they're also tested with water testing, with fans that blow water at hurricane force. So there's skyscrapers are very have very large price tags, and you have to make sure before they're built that every single possible condition is considered.
And the future cities that I know there was a World Science Festival in July, I believe, or maybe April. Are we going to see a lot more of these with actual people living in them and having, there was even something mentioned about urban farms growing local produce up in the sky?
I'm very, very skeptical about urban farms because one of the factors I like to emphasize about skyscrapers is something, a definition that Cass Gilbert, who designed the Woolworth Building back in the early 20th century, said about a definition of skyscrapers. He said, skyscraper is a machine that makes the land pay. They're really commercial architecture. They're created in order to make money. The high demand for location produces high rents, which produces high-rise buildings. And as I heard somebody, some economist comment, I think an investment banker can pay a little bit more rent than a tomato. So when you have places where there's great demand for space, as there is for New York and, you know, other world capitals, there you find the most skyscrapers. We have an exhibition right now that compares Hong Kong and New York, you know, two capitals of global finance, where people make high incomes and they want to be in a place of prestige, a place that's efficient, urbane, and the skyscraper is a way for a lot of people to crowd both their businesses and their living spaces into a desirable space.
And they're called vertical cities, aren't they, in a sense?
Vertical cities. It's interesting that people think about density usually in terms of congestion rather than efficiency or vibrancy. But if you take cities like Hong Kong and New York, where people really do want to be, where they, you know, they want to spend their leisure time, they want to go to restaurants and theaters and have a place to work and live, which is close to the center, that kind of vertical intensity also has a density of population, which is completely different than our sort of, you know, suburban sprawl, or if you take the other populous cities of the world like that are the most dense, like Cairo or Mumbai, where density is really congestion. So vertical density is a way of thinking of rationalizing how to pack people into space, which also is a very, ultimately for the future of cities, a very sustainable way to live, because people who live in skyscrapers and work in skyscrapers actually consume less energy than people who drive cars in order to travel a long way to an air-conditioned, spread-out workplace.
I'm glad that you have school groups coming, Carol, because I'm sure they're going to fantasize, and that's maybe where our new architects are going to come from, and you'll be inspiring them.
That's right. I mean, we always hope that that you can reach every child, but sometimes you reach one, you know, in a class, and you change their lives, and that's the way that, you know, people find their callings, and architects or engineers or people who want to build towers to make money. That's all part of the sort of magnificent combination, a collage that makes cities and great buildings.
Well, we certainly appreciate your being on the radio with us. Carol Willis, founder of Skyscraper Museum. She's a curator, and for more information, go to www.skyscraper.org. Thank you, Carol.
Thanks so much.
Bye.
Bye.
There are many healing therapies, but we want to talk about the latest healing therapies, including programs using Native American healings. And our next guest is Kathleen Brooks Weiss, who is the founder of the Next Step Institute of Integrative Medicine. Tell us what you do there, Kathleen.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. What we do here is very broad in terms of we address people's health on emotional, intellectual, spiritual, and physical levels. And some people who are coming to us are coming to us because they're at the end of their rope. They're coping with, you know, very serious diagnosis of MS or cancer or other really life-interfering, if not life-threatening, diseases. Other people are coming because they realize that their life is not really working the way they want it to work. And while those are very common problems experienced by almost everyone in the Western world, what we do differently is we say, let's address those problems from each part of the human experience. And also, when we say integrative medicine, we're not just talking about integrating the different segments of the human being. We're also talking about integrating all different healing therapies that we have tested and used ourselves, studied, and that have good history of actually helping. And so a person coming to the Institute may be exposed to Eastern medicine, Native American medicine, holistic American medicine, cutting-edge Western medicine. You know, they may have their medications changed. They'll meet with a naturopath. They'll do acupuncture. And as you mentioned, one of the most powerful tools that we have is the Native American Healing Center.
I'm glad to hear all that. And I was curious if you think being situated in the Colorado Rockies makes a difference.
Absolutely. We have been located in several different places in the United States, and we made a conscious decision to move up here and open this program in Vail, Colorado, primarily because we have heard from so many people that this is a place where they literally feel better when they get here. Despite the altitude bothering some people, most people respond by saying, I feel lighter, I feel more open, and the sheer magnitude of the beauty around them inspires them to look deeper into themselves. And also, it's a very challenging environment. It's a place where you want to get your hiking shoes on and go up into the mountains. You want to go horseback riding. We do have a horse facility for that reason. And the crystal purity of our environment really does speak to people about getting as well as they possibly can be to experience life at its fullest.
What is your background, actually, Kathleen?
I started as a psychotherapist in the field, in the very new field. I helped start the field of children of alcoholics and other dysfunctional families. And it's interesting, even though I started Next Step 25 years ago with a focus on a group of people who weren't being addressed, which was children in these dysfunctional families and the adults that they grow up to become, I find that everything has come full circle, because while I've also worked extensively with chronic pain and chronic illness, I find that all of these things fit together. The emotional trauma of youth often has echoes. Not necessarily are we saying that that trauma causes physical problems later in life, but certainly physical pain and illness can be an expression of unresolved emotional difficulty. And then my greatest blessing is that along the way with the Next Step Institute, we were brought in to consult with several Native American tribes who were trying to address the need to intervene in that generational cycle of addiction and abuse. And as a result, I found that the people I was working with were teaching me much more than I could ever teach them. The spirituality that I found while working on Native American reservations, especially among the elders who had not been brutalized by alcoholism, who had lived their lives the traditional spiritual ways, were so powerful to me. And then as sometimes life does this, I developed, had a diagnosis of advanced breast cancer myself, and was able to utilize all these different modalities that I had become familiar with in my work. And I am, after 6 years of both holistic and wonderful Western medical care, but primarily with a focus on the Native American spirituality, I am well. Not just alive, but really well and enjoying my life. So the work I do at Next Step has great personal satisfaction, as well as the excitement and the intellectual challenge of really finding very new approaches to very old problems.
That's a good way to put it. Why did you choose the name Next Step? What is the next step?
That's why, because whenever you find yourself in a quandary, whether it is, okay, I realized I had an alcohol problem, I've quit drinking, but now what? How do I deal with the other feelings I have? What's my next step? Okay, I've been through chemotherapy and radiation. My doctor says, well, we've done everything we can. And the patient says, no, there has to be something more I can do to fight this cancer. What's my next step? So 25 years ago, the concept was, what is our next step in dealing with the problems that people face in addictive families? Rather than just focusing on, can we get the alcoholic sober, what else do we look at? But as it has gone along over 25 years, we as an organization have just constantly been asking ourselves, what's the next step? What's the next challenge? And, you know, just today I was working with a patient who told me the whole story of what she had been through, what she had survived, and what she's still coping with. And she looked at me and she said, so what do you think is next? And so I think that's a very, very meaningful question for anyone to ask themselves, no matter whether they're dealing with physical difficulties, emotional difficulties, or just a general sense of unsettled or unwellness in their lives.
Sounds like you continually have cutting-edge programs. I know you have some new ones you're working on right now.
We are. We have just opened two new programs, one that specifically looks at MS and takes patients for 5 days in the Rockies, where they will be with other MS patients who have decided to stand up to the disease and fight it with everything that's available from all of those different modalities. We have also started a brand new program for cancer patients, same concept, 5-day visit in the mountains, dealing with not just their medical issues, but their spiritual issues, their emotional issues, and we are finding already just absolutely exhilarating responses from the patients. You know, there is healing to be found in every situation. Yes, there are some people who have gone back to their doctors and said, you know, I really feel I had a miracle, and test results confirm that. Other people go back to their doctors and say, tumor is still there, my MS is still there, but I feel I have a new way of addressing my life. And what we talk about here is optimal wellness, meaning I am not looking to say I must be perfectly healthy in every area of my life or else I'm not happy. There are some of us, and I'm one of them, who have been hit out of nowhere with a very, very serious illness. What can I do? Okay, so this terrible thing happened to me. What can I do to have that terrible thing have meaning in my life? And also, what can I do to strengthen my emotional and spiritual response to that terrible thing? And what we find that is so exhilarating is the patients are already calling and saying, you know, I'm beginning to see this whole thing as an adventure, as an invitation to a new way of living.
And I think the miracle is that there are going to be a lot of next steps happening there. So I want to thank you, Kathleen Brooks-Weiss.
Oh, thank you so much.
You are the executive director of Next Step Institute of Integrative Medicine. For more information, go to the web to nextstepinstitute.org. Thanks a lot, Kathleen.
Thank you.
Bye. So you have a dog and you are taking it on vacation. What if you could play music that would keep your dog relaxed and the driver alert? Joshua Leeds and Lisa Spector are involved with sound therapy for improving canine health and behavior. Psychoacoustics is a new science, and as you listen to the music in the background, it should be having an impact on your human nervous system. Lisa, does your experience both as a professional musician and as the founder of your music school in Half Moon Bay, California, make you understand why this works?
Well, I wouldn't say that alone makes me understand why it works. About 5 years ago, I had taken a seminar that Joshua Leeds was teaching on psychoacoustics, the principles of how sound affects the human nervous system. And it was in my application of those principles and applying them to my students at my music school that I noticed how effective they were in helping me teach them. And at the time, I was a volunteer puppy raiser for Guide Dogs for the Blind and started noticing the effect that certain kinds of music was having on the dogs in my care. And that's when I approached Joshua with the idea of applying these same principles that were working so effectively with humans and applying that to dogs to see how effective it could be at calming the canine nervous system.
Well, now, Joshua, you're a music producer and sound researcher, and you're author of the book The Power of Sound and Sonic Alchemy. So is this a new science?
Well, the emerging science of psychoacoustics has been around for many decades, but where we consider it to actually be a newer science is the merging of psychoacoustics, the study of the effect of music and sound on the human nervous system, with bioacoustics, which is the field that studies how it is that animals produce sound, how they use sound to communicate between each other, and also what is the effect of the human soundscape on their nervous systems. And so for us, the exciting thing about this marriage of these two disciplines of psychoacoustics and bioacoustics is that it is a wonderful way for us to begin to more fully understand the effect of our human soundscape on our animals, and it's a way for us to understand by observing what's taking place with the animals to even get a snapshot a little bit more clearly about how it is that sound is affecting us as well.
Well, we all know about clinical trials, and my curiosity is, do you give the dog a placebo, or how do you know when it is responding and when it's not?
Well, there are certain observations you can make about watching a dog, such as, is it lying down, or is it panting and pacing the room? Is the dog panting? Certain times, if a dog is yawning or lip-licking, it's often a sign of stress. And so observing the dog in that observation, but in other times it's extremely obvious. If you have a dog that's been barking wildly because he's been left alone and you play the music and he just goes to sleep, that's a pretty obvious sign that he's a lot calmer.
Okay, so now the music that you came up with, which we're going to play a little of, you have altered. Is that correct, Joshua?
Yes, that is correct. What I did was I took the same principles that I have been employing and either innovating or developing over the last 20-some-odd years for sound therapies that are used in clinics and classrooms around the world, quite often with children and adults with neurodevelopmental issues. I took the same principles of resonance, entrainment, and pattern identification, and I began to apply them to this music that was going to be used for the dogs as well. And I have to tell you, Anita, we actually, when we first set out in this research project about 5 years ago, Lisa and Dr. Susan Wagner, who's a veterinary neurologist, who became the research director for this project, and myself, we really did not know what we were going to find at the beginning of this research. And in the process of being able to take the music and being able to essentially simplify it, whereby we are taking complex material, and in the case of the compositions that you're going to be playing, both of them are the same Bach piece. The introductory piece that we heard is the original arrangement of it, and what we're about to hear is a rearrangement that was done by Lisa and myself. What we were attempting to basically do was to essentially regulate the complexity of auditory data into the nervous system. And with the concept that if you have a stressed or overwhelmed nervous system, your tolerance and your ability to be able to decipher quantities of data is actually diminished. And so rather than fight that trend, which takes place in two or four-leggeds, what we believed was that if we simplified the auditory data, that the mechanism, the nervous system, whether or not it's a dog or it's a cat or a zebra or a human being, that the ability to be able to take in what we call the nutrients of sound would be much more easily assimilable if the compositions were simplified.
That's an excellent explanation. Nutrients of sound. I have to remember that. Well, we're going to play this. So everyone just listen, and you remembered what we first played. Now let's hear this, and everyone just sit back and relax and see what it makes you feel like. As I'm starting to fall asleep.
Well, that's exactly what it was that we were looking to not only do with you, but to your four-legged as well. And basically what we did in that composition, that beautiful Bach piece, was we lowered it down an octave. We took what we had before was in the normal arrangement of it, an arpeggiated performance of the notes, and we made them into block chords. And then we also, at the same time, just basically simplified where it was that melody comes in and where it is that it comes out. The whole point being, if we feed the nervous system lower frequencies of sound, it tends to discharge or to essentially deeply soothe and relax the nervous system, as opposed to the high frequencies. We're slowing down the rhythm, and that creates an entraining effect whereby our primary pulse systems, brain waves, heart rate, and breath, will also begin to slow down. And at the same time, we have created a very habituated pattern where it does not take the process of active listening to be able to understand what's taking place, and so therefore, like a lazy lizard in the sun, we can just turn over and we can just allow ourselves to be able to relax because we're not concerned with trying to find a pattern. All of this, by the way, can be found on our website at throughadogsear.com, whereby we go into a lot of the information that is contained within the book, throughadogsear.com, as well as our new CD series, of which there are 3 CDs.
Well, let me talk to Lisa a moment here. And Lisa, I know you're not a lizard, but I know you're a lazy lizard there, but I have to, as a graduate of the Juilliard School, and you have your own music school there in California, mm-hmm. Are you doing the playing?
I am doing the playing, yes. And it's funny because when I, in my younger years, I was always known to be a very fast pianist. I played everything too fast. So it's kind of might be surprising to some of my colleagues, but here I am playing very, very slow music that's hard to stay awake to. But it really has become, in my career, it's really become the most rewarding playing I've ever done.
Well, I think what it is also is you are a dog lover. You actually are a volunteer puppy raiser for Guide Dogs for the Blind. And so you would see this even more so. I would think a blind dog needs this.
Well, it's the guide dogs who lead the blind people. It's a very stressful life for them. It's a very challenging life. They are really, literally, every single day, they put a human's life in their paws, so to speak, so that they make judgments. They make life or death decisions. You know, if the blind person tells them to cross the street and it's not safe to, they actually have to react against what they've been commanded to do. They're really, it's incredible what these service dogs can do.
Yes, I am familiar with that, and I didn't mean to say the dog was blind, but working with the blind, and I would think a blind person, I meant, has the music would really make them feel better, even though we talked about originally that in a car where you have a dog that's feeling very nervous and jumping around, and of course you probably have children jumping around, and then you're getting a little crazy. So this is something really very new, and I hope that people will realize there are things like this, so the next time that your dog or your cat or your kids get crazy, you can actually know that there is something that will help them. And I will give you the website for you to go and see if you can do something with it. And that is throughadogsear.com. Thank you both very much, and good luck with your work.
Thank you very much, Anita. Thank you.
In the coming weeks, you'll learn about a solar-powered attaché with the Juice Bags Profolio. Henry Gettenauer, co-owner of Rewear, the manufacturer, believes that there are many business people who are looking for a product that gives them the freedom to roam while staying plugged in. So why not have a Nobel Prize for programs that positively affect children? Well, now we do, thanks to Henry and Kay Leibowitz, who funded and founded World of Children, the only global recognition and funding program exclusively for those pioneering life-changing programs for children. And you're going to hear about an organization that provides needed services through an innovative way to serve people with Alzheimer's disease. Florida's rural areas are the beneficiary of having a first of its kind, a memory mobile. Chuck Albrecht, Senior Vice President of the Alzheimer's Association, Florida Gulf Coast Chapter, reports on its success. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Thanks for listening. I'm Anita Finley.